Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune into what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy. Yeah. Right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with.
Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a music stand, and I love films. As Oscar Wilde once said, the very essence of romance is uncertainty, but you should always go for it. Like, you may never understand Lost Highway, but you should definitely watch Lost Highway. Yeah, I agree, Oscar Wilde. It's a fucking great film. I have no idea if you could call it romantic, but it's definitely worth a watch. Fair play to you, son. Every week, I invite a special guest over. I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. Previous guests include Barry Jenkins, Kevin Smith, Jameela Jamil, and even Fed Crambles. But this week, it's the brilliant comedian, host, and author, Mr. Jimmy Carr. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get about an extra 20, 25 minutes with Jimmy, where we go deep talking about beginnings and endings. You get a truly shocking secret, and you also get the whole episode uncut, ad-free, and as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Ted Lasso Season 2 is now all available on Apple TV+. You can watch the whole thing in one go. Soulmate Season 1 is on Amazon Prime. You can watch that in one go. Although, you know, take your time with both of them. Why rush things? Do you know what I mean? Make it last. So, Jimmy Carr. Bloody hell. Imagine Jimmy Carr on the podcast. Jimmy Carr is a comedian, a writer, and a national treasure. He has written a new book, which is a mixture of autobiography and self-help. I thoroughly recommend it. It's out to buy now. We recorded this on Zoom a few nights ago. He was kind enough to record it. I can't remember what time it was. Like, I'm in America, he's in the UK. It was like 1 a.m. we started this. Like, that's very nice of him. Do you know what I mean? What a lovely man to do that. I was very grateful for his time. And I think you will really love this episode. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 172 of Films to be Buried With. Hello and welcome to Films to be Buried With. It is I, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by a writer, a multi-book writer, a TV writer, a TV sketch star, a TV presenter, an award winner, a stand-up, and one of the funniest and most legendary men in all of the land. Please welcome to the show, your hero and mine, please welcome, it's Mr. Jimmy Carr!
Well, I mean, I can't believe you're like, I presume you're worried we won't get on in this podcast and you were padding there with every possible sort of job title you could give me.
Yeah.
Basically, a stand-up comedian and a chancer is what it is. It's like stand-up comedian's the main job and everything else is a side hustle that's gone all right.
Now, Jimmy Carr, I am in America. You are in England. We are recording this on Zoom. What time of day is it and why are you up so late?
It's 12:30 at night. I was waiting for you to get through the LA traffic is the reason I'm up so late. No, I've just done a show in, I was in Sunderland, which is just near Newcastle. I'm now in Newcastle in a hotel. It's all very nice. It's nice to be back on tour, I'll be honest with you. It's quite nice to be working.
Yeah. How long have you been back gigging in real life in person?
Well, they opened. They said theatres could reopen on June 21st. So I've had maybe 4 nights off since then. It's now November. I've been pretty much on it straight away. I really enjoy it. I love it.
Yeah. You've also written a book.
Well, it was lockdown. And what happened in lockdown is I think most comedians were faced with a sort of ultimatum by their management. You can either do a podcast or write a book. And I took what I considered to be the dignified choice. I wrote a book. And great to be on your podcast, but really.
Come on. Put some effort in. So, I yesterday received your book and I've read 100 pages of it. That is not to say that I don't want to read the rest, but I have read the first third of it.
That's pretty impressive in a day, I think. That's getting through it.
Yeah. And it's really excellent. And if I may say, it's kind of, well, I'll let you pitch it, but then let me tell you what happened when I read it.
Well, it's kind of, it's an autobiography, but it's also my sort of love letter to stand-up comedy. And it's kind of about what I think about life. So I wanted it to sort of feel like meeting me, like being a friend of mine. And that's it, kind of to give an impression of what I'm like as a friend. So it's a bit self-helpy as well as being an autobiography. So it's meant to be like half about you and half about me. That's the pitch.
Yeah. And what I thought is there's a lot of like, it seems like your philosophy of life is you should all have a good life. That sort of seems to be what you're saying. It's like there's no reason you can't be having a good life. And it's all quite practical. And there's a lot of stuff. I really like the stuff you were saying about, you know, therapy and your parents. And at some point you have to forgive reality and your life is your own and all that stuff. There's a lot of that going on. And then there's a very short, it's like half a page on the, if I may talk about this very briefly, there's a very short half page on the death of your mother that's so fucking beautiful that it made me cry. And it's like, it's such a, I guess, realistic, but also very emotional and very, it's a really beautiful piece in the middle of
all. That's kind of where the book came from. Because the book came out of, there was an NHS kind of book. Which we did in the lockdown, which was to raise money for the National Health Service, some sort of charitable thing. We all sort of wrote essays about our experiences with the NHS. And as a result of kind of writing that essay, I got the book offer. So it sort of started with that thing of like remembering that and talking about it. And then, you know, kind of actually, you know, thinking back on, you know, it's an interesting thing. People don't talk about grief an awful lot and they don't write about it a lot. So I think when you do talk about it kind of, I've had a lot of nice comments, but I think if you write about it in any way, it's naturally very emotive because, of course, you project yourself onto it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And it's, you know, we've met a few times. And for the record, I will say this publicly. I did a audition for 8 Out of 10 Cats a long time ago, years ago. And I did a round with you in it. And you were so lovely and so like helpful to the people that weren't like shouting stuff out. You were like, hey, I remember you going like, Brett, what about you? What do you think? Because I hadn't said anything for about 5 minutes. And I remember thinking, that's very nice that you were keeping an eye on things.
I'm a consummate host, me.
Yeah, very, very good. But one of the times we met, you said to me, you were suggesting things like I should be doing podcasts and stuff like that, as in to be a guest on. And you were like, because you talk about confessional stuff, you talk about your life, and you said, I don't really do that. I don't like doing any sort of emotional stuff. And I thought, that's very interesting, because it feels like now that's not true.
I think there's been a bit of a shift. I think I sort of feel like I've done maybe 20 years in comedy and not really given much away. And I kind of feel like it's appropriate now. I became a father about 2 years ago. Exactly 2 years ago. Thank you very much. And then I feel like I've kind of, I'm like in my late 40s now. I feel like I can share. I've got like a little bit of wisdom to share, and it doesn't seem inappropriate. I think sometimes I was a bit, weird for a comic. I think I was a bit, it's a weird thing. People are very nuanced. I'm incredibly confident in lots of ways. And also I was a little bit shy and embarrassed about talking about myself. I didn't want to talk about stories from my life because I thought they'd be boring. So there's something about my style of comedy that if you're kind of paging Dr. Freud, it's like, yeah, I tell a joke 3 times a minute to avoid having to talk about anything serious.
Yeah. All your comedy is saying, don't look at me, don't look at me, don't look at me while you're looking at me.
Yeah. So there is something now. I'm writing new stuff. I'm just kind of writing a new show at the moment just to switch up the tour with slightly longer kind of set pieces in it, like more routines rather than one-liners, which I'm really enjoying, I must say.
As someone who does routines and not one-liners, isn't it great? So much less work.
It does seem to be. I mean, I thought I was robbing a living before, but this is great. Now, I mean, it's still my love language is one-liners, so it's always going to be peppered with one-liners. But to make to talk about being a father or to talk about something that's going to be, you're going to do a sustained chat for sort of 12 minutes on stage with a lot of one-liners in it. I think changing style sort of comedically as well is a really interesting thing to do to kind of make it feel fresh. I think I'm confident I've got the best job in the world, for me.
Yeah.
But it's that thing where you go, how do you keep it fresh every year? How do you make it sort of new? And part of that was going outward and touring the world and doing 40 different countries. And part of it's kind of going, well, actually, the mechanics of what you do, changing that up. But making sure that you're always kind of growing, every day's a school day.
Love it. Absolutely love it. When you think back on when you were saying, I'm worried about talking about myself because I'm boring. Like, did you feel like you were hiding something? Or it was just like, I'm not interesting, so I have to do...
Yeah, I think it was kind of, I'm not interesting. I think it was that partly that thing of like going, I'm a middle-class white boy from the suburbs. It's like, I really have a lot to add. It feels like people that look like me have been in charge for 10,000 years. Do they really need to hear more of it? It's a bit of that. It's obviously, I'm not exactly who you think I am either, it transpires in the book, it's kind of an Irish immigrant family and it's always more interesting than you think. I think probably people sort of assume I went to a private school and was, got that kind of, I think people make assumptions and you're kind of at your peril to correct them because it's more of a hassle. Just go with it.
Interesting.
It's two things. You've got to be aware of who you are and you have to be aware of how you're perceived. They rarely match up exactly.
But you also were like, judging by your book, although it's very clear at 25, right? At 25, you quit your good job to go and have this adventurous life. But it sounds like you were having an adventurous life before it. You was traveling to places and doing, it seems like you were constantly going.
No, I think it was a pretty boring life before. Pretty boring. I think I was like middle management in an oil company, which has only changed maybe the last maybe 3-4 years. It's become the terrible thing to have done. Like working for an oil company is like, in retrospect, I worked for the Nazis. It's like, it was literally, I mean, my job was just to strangle seabirds. That's what I did.
Right.
That was my specialist area.
Well, and it needed being done. And we appreciate you. We appreciate your service.
Thank you.
Jimmy Carr, I've forgotten to tell you something. Fuck.
We're taping this? Yes.
I've gone to tell you, and I should have told you. I should have at least had your team tell you before this.
Go on.
I'll just say it. I feel like a dickhead not saying this up front. You've died. You're dead.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's tough. Mm. I'll be honest with you. I often get this feeling on planes. I'm not a nervous flyer, but I often feel like on a plane, you're kind of out of control. And if you stop for a minute to think we are flying through the sky at 600 miles an hour, this is madness. And I often think it's a very good measure of your life to go, if it all ended right now, I've had a hell of a ride. I'd feel pretty, it wouldn't be a terrible, oh my God, I missed that thing. It would be, this is the chances of being alive, infinitesimally small. So it's been great. Thanks very much. I've had a lovely time.
Hey, you're welcome. You're absolutely welcome. I really like that. I think that's a huge sign of your life, that if you think I'd die tomorrow, I had a good run.
Yeah.
I mean, that's lovely. How did you die, by the way?
I would want to die. I mean, I've planned my suicide in some detail, as is anyone.
Please.
I mean, come on.
Of course.
So my plan for suicide, and hear me out on this, is I fly to South Africa. It's quite a long flight. There's no jet lag because you're in the same time zone. It's great. So flight's 10 hours. It's enough time to really give life some thought. Are you sure you want to do this? If you decide on landing in Cape Town, you want to do this. You drive to Camps Bay. You get on one of the shark boats where they go out and they look at the great whites. There's lots of great whites there. You get on the back of the boat. You cover yourself in chum, in the meat and the blood. And you jump in the sea with the great whites and you get ripped apart. That's the way to go, because if you're going to kill yourself, you got to be sure. You got to be sure. You've got to go, okay, so there's something so bad that this is the better option. Great.
Yeah, and you've got the journey to really question it.
Perfect. And then, it's a perfect suicide. My problem with suicide, too easy. Too easy for people. Mm. It should be a really painful, terrible thing.
Famously too easy.
Well, I talk about it a lot in the book. It's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. It's a lack of perspective. Mm. And I think one of the great things that comedy gives people, one of the great powers of comedy, is a bit of perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a shark-based suicide is how I die.
Also, what's good about that death is it's memorable. It sort of means...
It washes everything clean. It literally, if Michael Jackson had died in that way, no one would mention those kids again. It would be forgotten.
Exactly.
Well, what, you mean 100%. Michael Jackson that died of the shark thing? Yeah.
Yeah. I just worry you'll be annoyed how little people are talking about your career and all your success if you die that way. That it will be in like years to come. Jimmy Sharkman, the dead shark guy.
Yeah, sure. No, I'd be all right with it. But I mean, legacy's not really for comedians, I don't think.
Well, that's interesting. Go on. Is it because comedy always dates and we're all fucked every 5 years?
Yeah, comedy slightly rots, I think, as opposed. But it's a moment thing. I think life is a moment thing. Mm-hmm. I think leaving a legacy, I think, is a vestige of our religious belief. It's wanting to live forever. In the same way that sort of fame has replaced heaven in a secular world. It's like sort of, we've still got those sort of religious things. We still have those desires. They've just sort of supplanted onto different things. So the idea that we want legacy and we want to be remembered forever is we want to live forever.
Mm. So what do you think happens when you die?
I don't really believe in an afterlife. I believe in a next life, but I don't believe in an afterlife.
Like a Buddhist thing, like you just come back?
No, like a literal, like 10 years ago, I was a different guy than the guy I am now. I'm now a father. I live here. I do this. I've written a book, and then in another 20 years time, I'll be someone else. It'll change. I was someone different before I was 25, working in a boring office job. I was an academic when I was in my early 20s. I was a comedian in my 30s. It's like it changes a little bit. And you, at some stage, I'll be, God willing, an elder statesman of comedy. It's like it changes. There are next lives. You meet new people, you have new friends, you're constantly meeting new people, you're in a new environment. It's like nurturing never ends. I think there's a perception in our society that you're done when you're 18 or 21 or whatever it is, that you go, right, that's me, and I'm a solid state noun. And I sort of think, well, we're verbs. We're doing things and we can do better and we change. And there's good phases and bad stages. There's hell and heaven right here.
So at the end, it's the end. There's your next life, your next life, your next life, and then...
Yeah, when you die, that's it. You're done. And I'm perfectly fine with that. I cannot imagine a world without me.
None of us can.
No one can. It's a terrible thought. But like, no one ever gives any thought to what it was like the moment before their conception. All the thought is what happens afterwards. No one ever thinks, well, I don't remember what happened before, but somehow the universe was fine. I mean, people often talk about the Big Bang, but I'm super interested in what happened 30 seconds before the Big Bang.
Yes.
That's more interesting to me, that end of things.
Interesting. Can I ask you something else?
Yeah.
However you want to put, I don't know how you think of it, but you're an institution. You're very much someone who is on our TVs and has been for many, many years and continues to be. You're kind of always there. And this is a good thing. I'm not saying this is a bad thing.
It's not for me to use the term legend, but I mean, I guess that's what we're getting to, right? Yeah, no, yeah. I've had a good career.
It's quite a rare space to get. And I think there's only a few people probably in 10 years that occupy that space where like you're constantly in our living rooms and it's a good thing. And it isn't like there's a weird bit before that, I think, with some people where people can become like overexposed. And then
I think you have to get overexposed. Getting overexposed is like that weird phase where you get famous. I remember the Christmas it happened to me. I remember like doing loads of like clip shows and things, and we'd recorded a bunch of them. And then it transpired that all were going to be on over one Christmas. And it was just, I was all over Channel 4. You kind of went from being that guy from that thing to being, oh, you're Jimmy Carr.
And you seem to me, but I really don't know you, so you tell me if this is true. You seem to be someone who enjoys being famous, who is comfortable, who likes...
I think it's the natural state. I genuinely think that we're... No, I mean that seriously. I think we're tribal creatures. We're built to live in groups of 60 to 80. That's what we're built for the longest time. And the existence that we currently have, which is very much focused on the individual, not the tribe, is a much more recent kind of invention. And it's happenstance. It's because of our technology and our cultures and how cities have grown that we live with strangers. We're meant to live with people that we know. So being famous is like, it's sort of half of living in a village because everyone knows you. It's like living in a lovely, friendly village, but you've got Alzheimer's because everyone knows you and you don't know them.
That's great. What a great way of looking at it.
I do like being famous, though. It's a job. I mean, people that moan about it can just, I mean, how far can they fuck off?
So, Jimmy Carr, you're wrong, my friend. You're wrong. There's a heaven.
Oh, well, that's tremendous.
Yeah, and you got in, believe it or not, despite your disgusting attitude towards heaven, you did get in because that's what heaven's like.
Wow.
And it's filled with your favourite thing. What's your favourite thing?
Comedy.
Right, it's wall-to-wall comedy.
Great.
So there's gigs going on everywhere. There's legendary performances being done by the real person redoing them. The seats are made of one-liners. You love it there. But in this heaven, they won't talk about your life. They won't talk about your life through the medium of film, because that's what it's like there. That's the bit they miss out in the Bible. And the first thing they ask you is, what's the first film you remember seeing, Jimmy Carr?
You know, listen, long time listener, first time caller to the podcast. I have to say the first film I saw was Bambi, and I know that's annoying because we've been there before. I guess you've interviewed people around my age and they watch Bambi, but I've got a couple of early movie stories because Bambi was the first one, and that became my fear in childhood became losing my mother. I think it had such a profound effect on me. And then actually the loss of my mother was a massive catalyst in my life. So it did become thematically, I feel like Bambi is a character I can absolutely relate to.
Wow. That's fucking huge.
But it was, you know, it's that for a lot of people. I think it's going to be a Disney movie. It's going to be something. And the size of the screen. I remember going there and it becoming kind of an apocryphal tale in the family that I got to the cinema and went, where are the buttons? Because TVs used to have buttons on the side for turning it on and off and stuff. And I was going, this is immense, but where are the buttons for this thing? Who's got the remote?
Turn it down.
This was the days before remotes, actually. Remotes were on strings back then. I'm quite an old man.
Oh, wow. And you saw it with your mum?
I think, I saw it with my mum, which was, I would say not great. Just kind of like checking she's there every 2 minutes. But then I went to see, I was like, I think we used to go to a place in Ireland every summer for like 6 weeks. Every summer went to a little town called Kilkee. And I remember being taken to see Jaws when I was maybe 4 or 5. I mean, I was very, very young, and seeing Jaws and just being absolutely terrified. Just like going, well, I don't want to be near any, like we're going swimming every day up until that point. And then afterwards, like an absolute line in the sand going, well, that's not happening.
So fascinating that Bambi started you off and that became a defining feature of your life, fear of losing your mum, then you lose your mum and that starts you off on your journey. And then Jaws is how you end your life.
Yeah, it's perfect, right? Perfect. And then I remember
you get storytelling.
Being scared in the cinema is a huge kind of thing for me. I always liked horror movies. And I remember sort of seeing things early on. It's amazing the stuff that scares you when you're a kid. I remember then like being quite young, getting taken to see Airplane when it came out. And they used to do, and I'd kind of forgotten about it till thinking about the podcast. And I was thinking, I remember going to see Airplane and there was a movie at the start, like with the short movie. I mean, kids won't be able to remember this, but there used to be a short movie before the main feature. And it was like a comedy movie about a werewolf. And I remember it being absolutely fucking terrifying. Because somehow you forgot the jokes. By the time you got home, you'd forgotten the jokes. You just remember the creepy werewolf bit.
That's great. Have you ever found that short again?
I never saw it again. I mean, I'm sure it has not stood up. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't terrify me now. But it's weird, those things that kind of stay with you when you're a kid, like a little bit of imagery from a film or something kind of special. It's they've always been my sort of happy place films. I really associate it with going, everything being okay at the cinema. And I associated it when I started doing comedy, I associated it with freedom. I used to do a thing when I was working for Shell Oil where I would put in a meeting on a Friday. I put in a meeting at 11 a.m., maybe 11:30. And then I put in a meeting at 2. So in my diary that everyone could see. And then I would go to Leicester Square, walk to Leicester Square from the Strand. And then I would go and see a movie. Well, like the whatever was coming out that week, I'd go and see a movie and be covered for that time. And it was, oh, yeah, I had a meeting there and a meeting there. Great. It's perfect.
That's great.
And then when I started doing comedy, I remember, like, obviously I'd had a reputation for being a hardworking comedian, but it's like being the best looking guy in the Burns Ward. No one's doing anything. So I would go to a movie every Friday. I remember going sort of in the afternoon on a Friday. And just that thing of the movies in the afternoon is like heaven for me. Walking out and the sun hitting your eyes and just you've seen something and it's, you're kind of, I love it. And I like going on my own.
Oh, me too. It's the best way. Tell me, you also write things. Have you written films? Do you want to make films?
I've written a couple of things, but I mean, it really reminds me of that. There's a famous Peter Cook line. So Peter Cook's at a cocktail party in the 1960s and he's, you know, drinking and, you know, goes up to someone and says, what are you up to? And they say, oh, I'm writing a novel. And he says, neither am I. I feel movie scripts are a bit, neither am I. It's like, yeah, sure, I'm writing a film. Great.
Yeah.
And I've been to Hollywood and you could die of encouragement.
You really could. What about, so you like being scared. What's the film that scared you the most?
Well, it depends which, there's different levels of fear, aren't there? I think The Exorcist 3 is as scary as a horror movie as you're ever going to get. The Exorcist is obviously a classic. The Exorcist 2 is some dog shit. Terrible.
Yeah.
The Exorcist 3 is a brilliant movie. It's got a couple of brilliant sequences in it. I love horror movies generally. And it's great. I absolutely loved it.
What do you make of the comedy horror thing parallel? Is it the same thing in terms of the reaction you're trying to get, timing and everything from an audience?
I think it probably has. I mean, there's certainly a lot of parallels. I think anything where you're getting strong emotion out of someone where they don't really have a choice. Comedy for me, I always thought like your sense of humor is a bit like your sexuality or your choice in food. How spicy you like it, it is not really up to you. It's like that's your settings. So you go, I like spicy food and kinky sex and edgy comedy is like, okay, that's, and some people like the mild stuff. Some people like, no, just some pasta with butter for me and some observational comedy. Thanks very much.
That's really interesting. Yeah, go on.
Well, no, that thing of like what frightens you as well, what gets you, like it changes different stages of my life. I've been scared by different things. I think in my teenage years, probably, I don't know, 18, 19 or whatever, I remember watching Shoah and being sort of terrified because you sort of go, like the first time you get exposed to that and go, like it's suddenly not a statistic. You go, oh, this can fucking happen. That's terrifying because that's the world that we live in. I remember my own particular thing when I was growing up being the threat of kind of the 4-minute warning or 3-minute warning. Was the 4-minute warning of like, oh, they're going to drop the bomb. That was for my generation. That was our kind of, oh, right, that's going to happen. So something like When the Wind Blows was really kind of really frightening. There was another one. There was more TV shows than films that kind of captured that and were just like straight up horrifying.
Threads? Did you ever see Threads?
Yeah. I mean, Matt Morgan made me get it again recently, got it on DVD. It's like, it's fantastically scary.
You know, the man who made Threads made one of my favorite films, LA Story.
Really?
Imagine that as a double bit.
Wow. That's good. Yeah. I like it when people are very eclectic in their movies. I like the guy, my favorite is the guy that made Mad Max, also made Happy Feet. And you go, I mean, that's a fucking, what? That's a CV and a half,
Babe.
Isn't it? Yeah.
And Babe.
And then Happy Feet 2, he came back for more. I haven't finished that story.
And now, is the thing I think is interesting about horror and comedy, and weirdly when you mention sexuality, I think it's true of sexy films, horror films and comedy films are generally underrated. They don't get like critical acclaim
as much because your
dramas.
You don't require a critic for comedy. I mean, you never have, or a horror movie. It's a visceral response. It's binary. You either laugh or you don't. You're either scared or you're not. So it doesn't require, you know, sometimes when you go and see, you know, a musical, let's say, a critic can really add value. You know, it's really like, oh, did I enjoy that? And then they say something and you go, oh, yeah, I didn't know. I had it recently on, my missus is obsessed by musicals. So I go and see a lot of musicals. And I saw Bat Out of Hell, the musical. Challenging for me because not my... Anyway, saw this thing. And then I read a review and it went, oh, well, basically, this is the Peter Pan story. It's about children that won't grow up, but they set it in a teenage world, not a children's world. And immediately you go, oh, yes, this critic has added such value. I now understand what... Okay, that makes more sense. Great, what a good story. But most of the time, like for comics, you don't need a fucking... You know, someone that tells me, oh, I don't think that comic's funny, you go, yeah, it's very opinion... I mean, really opinion-based on this. Yeah. You either... I hate critics for comedy, like coming to the show, because you go, everyone else bought a fucking ticket. You've just rocked up and gone, this guy's a bit crude. Yeah, if you're not laughing, what I do is hate speech.
What's the film that made you cry the most? And are you at all a crier? You may be a big crier for all I know.
Yeah,
so
I'll cry at a movie. I think the one that sprang to mind that I would recommend to everyone is Nobody's Fool.
With Paul Newman?
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
I love that film.
It's gorgeous and it made me sort of weep. And it's about, I don't have a relationship with my father, but it's about fathers and sons and it's about friendships and it's about a father figure, I think. And it's beautiful. It's about kind of what it is to be. It's a great film about masculinity, and there's very few of those, I think, knocking around the place. So that's pretty good. I mean, something like Gallipoli will put me in a puddle, obviously, but I think that's who's not. How fast are you going to run? As fast as a rabbit. Oh, God. It's just too much. Magnolia made me cry a lot.
Oh, mate.
Magnolia is like, it's just, it's so perfect. And the one, latterly, I had a thing. You know, like on a plane, sometimes on a plane, I'll take a chance on something. I'll go, well, I'll watch. Yeah, I'll give that a go. And I watched a movie, a German film called Into the Fade. Did you see Into the Fade?
It's
Diane Kruger is in it. I mean, if you haven't seen it and you want to take a punt, I would go and it's phenomenal. But that just had me.
Do you cry alone or are you okay crying in front of other people?
I'm a pretty ugly crier, but yeah, I'm fine crying in front of other people. I always think like if you feel it. It tends to be very fleeting with me. Like it's just like very sort of, you know, a couple of snot bubbles and you're gone. And then I'm fine out the other end. I do remember as a kid as well, like the first time you see a movie that's like properly heartbreaking and it being like you don't sort of know where to put that emotion. But it's a great way to sort of connect. I do it a lot through music now. Like I remember when I watched The Elephant Man for the first time, just kind of, the end of that film where you just go, oh, it's just life is brutal. I mean, quite something. Quite something.
That is quite something.
And you remember, I remember where I was when I saw it. I remember the top loading VCR. I remember the whole sort of experience of seeing it and just thinking this is just kind of otherworldly. I'd never really felt that emotion before.
Yeah. What do you make of, because you seem to be into all this stuff. I was talking to someone the other day about the thing of like, I love horror films and I love films, but occasionally there are images in a film, like particularly in a horror film or something, that have been so horrific, you know, specifically to me, and maybe you wouldn't have thought the same, but like where it feels almost like PTSD, like I run it in a loop, that image, and part of me goes, I don't think I should have seen that because my brain seems to react as if it happened rather than I'm just watching a film. Do you know what I mean? And I always wonder if there are your caveman brain or some part of you that's like being caught. It's the same thing as it happening because you've seen it. Like if it happened in front of me in real life, it would be horrific. But then I saw it in a film and it would.
But I mean, that's ultimately what, you know, I think, especially when you're a child sort of with cinema, I mean, you've got to be very careful because that's sort of where phobias are from. Phobias, you know, it's basically you've kind of recoded a memory as if it's your life is in danger. So a lot of people are scared of spiders, let's say, because they were small and they saw a spider on the floor and it moved weirdly and they felt threatened by it. Like, oh my God, something bad's going to happen because that's an important thing to have from a Darwinian evolutionary point of view. And then they've kind of recoded that. So often you see something when you're a kid or see something sort of in a movie and you kind of, that terrible thing's going to hurt me. And you're kind of, you know, you're protecting yourself. I think the thing about horror movies as well is those kind of the archetypes, the storytelling there, it's always similar themes. I think they're really good sort of thematically, horror movies sometimes because they've got that kind of the Jungian archetypes are there. So it's, of course, you get it. I mean, one of my favorite movies is Cabin in the Woods. It's such a clever, brilliant sort of summation of all those kind of slasher horror movies and why I love them so much. I thought it's a brilliantly written, I think it's a really seriously underrated movie. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's fucking great.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49%. Based on credit worthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Stacy thought she had the perfect husband. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover for Justin Rutherford to hide behind.
They led me into the house, and I mean, it was like a movie.
He was sitting at our kitchen table. The cops were guarding him.
Stacy learned how far her husband would go to save himself.
I slept with a loaded gun next to my bed.
He did not just say, I wish he was dead. He actually gave details and explained different scenarios on how to kill him.
He, to me, is scarier than Jeffrey Dahmer.
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is. Jimmy Carr, what is the film that you love that most people do not like? It is not critically acclaimed, but you love it. You don't care what any of these fools say to you.
I would go rom-coms are the critical, sort of the area that I go, they don't get any critical love. They are the greatest films. They're enjoyable time and time again. It's like Four Weddings is perfect. I won't have a word said against it. It's just a perfect movie. It's funny. It's light. You could watch it as many times as you want. It's kind of 2 hours in good company. It's just lovely. And everything's sort of all right in that world, other than the funeral.
But they did warn you about that.
Yeah, they did warn you. Yeah, in fairness, they did tell us.
That's a really good answer. And it hasn't come up.
Really? Four Weddings?
I don't think so. Not for a very, very long time.
Well, maybe people do. Maybe it is critically. I mean, the other one that I really like is things like Mean Machine. I like movies like, Burt Reynolds in a prison. So I watched it again recently and thought, oh God, this has stood up so fantastically. I loved it. I tried to copy his haircut. He was great.
Yeah, you got it. Burt Reynolds has really stood up. What is the film that you used to love? You loved it. This is kind of the opposite. But you've watched it again recently and you've thought, oh no, I don't like this anymore. But that can be for whatever reason that might be to you.
A Birth of a Nation or Triumph of the Will. Those are my answers. Let's just move on.
You really? Say no more. Understood. No. And let me just hope that the way your opinion has changed is in the right direction.
Imagine if someone did just go, yeah, Birth of a Nation. Yeah, I don't know. The last couple of years, I really feel like it's lost something. I think probably the special effects movies, the amazing special effects movies that were basically, it was all on the special effects. And then you watch it again and you go, oh my God, I thought, Jurassic Park, oh my God, they've invented dinosaurs. This is incredible. And then you watch it again and go, oh, is it kids' TV? What's this? And it's kind of like that thing of, I remember as a child seeing Clash of the Titans and looking at those kind of effects and going, well, they're kind of dog shit, but interesting. You know, the Clash of the Titans thing, like the stop motion animation. It's like that. I love Clash of the Titans. I love those movies when I was a kid. Clash of the Titans, I thought was brilliant. And it's kind of a forgotten. It's not really like in this. When I was a kid, that was as big as Star Wars in my world, in my kind of mind. Right. It was huge. And then they just disappeared entirely. And the Medusa with the snakes for the head. It's great imagery. Yeah. I loved it. It kind of really brought that Greek mythology to life. Effects movies 10 years later never stand up well.
That's fair. Jimmy Carr, what's the film that means the most to you. Not necessarily the film itself is any good, but because the experience you had around seeing the film that will always make it special to you.
Okay, well, we're going to come right back to Bambi in this. I think the day after my mother died, we just didn't know what to do. We just like, I've got two brothers and we just kind of were sort of a bit broken. There's a real physical aspect to grief that people don't really talk about. But when you're bereaved, it sort of hits you and you're just a bit like, I don't know, you're kind of exhausted. And sort of the next day we sort of went, well, should we just go and see a film? And we went to see Moulin Rouge and I cried, I think from start to finish, the whole thing with my brother was 14 and, you know, he was like, he came, you know, he sort of sat there and we loved that kind of music. And I loved that. I haven't been able to watch it since. I was properly in a puddle in the darkness of the cinema and just able to grieve. And I thought it was amazing.
How old were you?
I was maybe 25.
Okay. Oh man, that's a killer story. That is a really killer story. What is the film that you most relate to, Jimmy Carr?
I mean, I remember sort of thinking something like The Rachel Papers when I was a kid. I remember thinking, well, that's my life, trying to get into college. And but it moves, you know, you outgrow it a little bit. I don't know. I'm a big fan of late 90s hero's journey cinema. Mm-hmm. So things like Fight Club and Trainspotting, Beautiful Girls, I thought was a movie. Did you ever see Beautiful Girls?
I love Beautiful Girls. I really loved that.
I watch Beautiful Girls once a year. I watch it every Christmas. I just think it's incredible soundtrack, and it's about that melancholy of going home and your home doesn't exist anymore. And yeah. I kind of had that experience, and it's kind of brutal, but that kind of thing of like, it's interesting. The movies, when I was thinking about the podcast before, the movies that sort of mean most to me are the ones just before I found my purpose in life, just before I found what I wanted to do. And you're kind of looking for signals through these stories. You're looking for, to quote another film, you're looking for a life less ordinary.
Wow. You're very good at this, Jimmy, by the way.
I don't know. I'm just naming films I like. It feels very easy.
20 points so far. Here we go. It's the one everyone's been waiting for. What's the sexiest film you've ever seen, Jimmy Carr?
Come Guzzling Sluts 4?
That is a classic.
I mean, if you haven't seen the first three, though, it's meaningless. You won't follow any of it.
I know.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think that's genuinely a tough question on, like, what's the... I've got a story about sexy, inappropriate sexy movies, though, if you would like to hear it.
Please. That's why we're here.
It is a piece of stand-up that I'm doing, but it's also a true story. My mother sort of brought us up on her own. Didn't, but sort of did. And she would take us out to the cinema quite a lot. And I was about 13 or 14, and I saw 9.5 weeks with my mum. And obviously, she's an intelligent woman. She realised the mistake that she had made.
1 week in.
Immediately. Like, yeah, 1 week into the 9.5. She was, this
eight
is...
8.5 to go.
This is not great. No, she realised almost immediately, but kind of went, well, we're here now, and what are we going to leave and do what? And I guess we'll stay. And, you know, kind of watching sex on TV with mum and dad is weird. Watching in the cinema is kind of weirder again. It's, so... sat through that. I mean, the joke is, she said to me during one of the sex scenes, quite a visceral sex scene, she went, "They'll sleep tonight," which is just such a great line. I suppose there was a thing of like the, you know, it's for people listening to this in the UK, there was a thing like Channel 4 would put sort of sexy movies on, sort of semi pornographic films, sort of on a sort of Thursday night quite late, which was quite an exciting thing. If it had a red triangle, it was going to be, oh, this would be pretty decent. There was a whole subset of movies as well that have had like a bit of boob in them. That was always a thing.
The bit of boob genre.
Things like Porky's, which until very recently, I think was the most successful Canadian movie of all time.
Really?
Because it had like a little bit of kind of, it was kind of that weirdly, that sort of Grease era Americana sort of thing, and had a little bit of sex in it. That felt like a very sort of, That felt like a very sexy movie when I was sort of 12, 13, when those things,
yeah.
Before really the, I mean, you got to remember, we lived in a world pre-internet pornography. We were so starved of, porn was something you had to find in the woods.
Yeah, yeah. And it was passed down through generations. So is your answer to Troubling Boners Worrying Why Duns 9.5 weeks with your mum?
I mean, that would be the one. You're not going to get better than that in terms of going, this is weird, watching something a bit sexy with your mum. You know, it's...
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
It's impressive to in the cinema as well. Okay, Jimmy Carr. Objectively, might not be your favourite, but objectively, what is the greatest film of all time?
I think the greatest film of all time has to be your favourite, because I think we can all quote something very, you know, French and meaningful. But True Romance, for me, is the greatest film of all time by some margin. I watch it all the time. I can't get enough of it. I find the music to be, that's enough for me. If it was just the opening sequence with the Badlands music, it's the music from another great film, isn't it? It's the same sort of, xylophone kind of effect as they use in Badlands, which is the great Terrence Malick movie. It's a Quentin Tarantino script, so you know it's going to be good. It's Tony Scott directing. Everyone in it is fucking brilliant. It's got the best scenes. I know that sounds sort of redundant, like, of course, movies are made of scenes, but there's such great set pieces. The Christopher Walken, Dennis Hopper bit is maybe the greatest scene in cinema. It's as good as it's ever going to get. And then the James Gandolfini is a heartbreaker. I mean, the whole thing's just start to finish brilliant. Great soundtrack, brilliant dialogue, incredible story. You know, the whole thing as well, and it's the kind of that hero's journey of the whole thing just works for me.
I love it. You know, you must know if you're that obsessive, but I like this about it that in the original script,
of course,
Clarence he died, and that Tony Scott was like, I just love them too much. I don't want it to happen. And I really like that. I like that he was like, I get it. I get that that's your vision, but I really like them. I don't want them to die. And I'm like, yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, there's something, there is something nice about the ending. And I think it's, I always think cinemas, whatever, however you want to interpret it, that's like, that's what you got from it, then great. And if you go, well, I think that's just a dream sequence and he's not really there. I mean, the movie would be my favorite movie just for the Elvis only appearing in the toilet.
Yeah. Great answer. Not been put in that category before. I'm going to give you 10 points.
Val Kilmer playing Elvis and you don't even see his face. Just phenomenal.
Five stars, 10 points. Jimmy Carr, what's the film that you could or have watched the most over and over again? Been a few you've said here that you watch every year.
There's a couple on rotation. But... there's True Romance, there's Beautiful Girls.
Fight Club I watch an awful lot. I think it's just fantastic. Trainspotting I watch maybe once a year.
I love it. I love the performances, I love the language, I love that. It's just fantastic.
This is actually a question that I have in the Resurrection episodes, but I'm worried I'll never get to speak to you again. So I want to ask you this question. I don't normally do this. In this one, if you could make one film that already exists that you think realistically the sort of film that could come out of your brain if you had all the skills, all the money, all the everything, what's the film that you wish you'd made that you feel like, yeah, that's a good representation of the sort of thing I'd love to do?
I mean, you just sort of flatter yourself and go, well, I do a work of a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. Would you?
It's Birth of a Nation, let's be honest.
On the buses, which outgrossed James Bond the year it came out.
It's a classic.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what the kind of, I don't know the kind of cinema that I really like. I mean, I really like documentaries. There's the other thing that I'm slightly obsessive about. I watch documentaries pretty much all the time. And I'm a huge fan of Adam Curtis. And I sometimes think the polemic documentary is a wonderful art form. And it's a great sort of, it's I think where the most sort of learning happens. I think I tend to, I don't know, I've kind of gone away from stories since becoming creative. So I think pre the age of 25, 26, I read a lot of fiction. I felt like I needed stories more before I was doing something creative when I was working to live. And now I live to work. I feel like I don't need stories in that sense as much. So cinema still means a lot to me, but it's not the same obsession. Like the idea that I'm talking to you now, the new Dune movie is out. It's been out for a week and I haven't seen it yet. I mean, I'm going to see it, but I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
There's a bit of me that's dying inside even telling you that. There's a bit of me going, right. You should have been there on Friday at the 10 a.m. showing to see it before anyone else. There's a bit of me that it mattered more when that's kind of all I had. That's not really an answer to anything. That's just, I'm treating this like a therapy session now.
No, and I really appreciate that you are. Do you have a fantasy in your head? I assume your baby is too young yet, but in your head, is it like a nice fantasy to be taking your son to the cinema one day? Is that part of your...
Oh, yeah, I hadn't really given that any thought, but yes, that will be a lovely thing. I think it's that thing, though, where you've got to get overexcited. Dads get overexcited and go, yeah, you've got to see Star Wars. He's three.
Yeah.
And they go, no, they're not going to understand any of this or get any of it. So it's having to wait like another 2 years before he can watch that. And he can see Bambi as well when he's in his 40s.
Yeah, I really respect that. You'll be like, you're watching Taxi Driver before you're watching Bambi, all right?
Yeah.
You're five. Now sit down.
Yeah.
We don't like to be negative, Jimmy. Maybe you do. I don't know. But what's the worst film you've ever seen?
I've only walked out of the cinema like a handful of times. And I think I took a chance on... I mean, it's actually... I think as most stand-up comics will know, the cinema is often... It's a very exciting thing where you go and see a fantastic piece of creative work. Sometimes, though, it's a Wednesday afternoon and you're in Birmingham and you've got to kill it. You've got to kill this afternoon somehow. You're on your third wank by two in the afternoon. You go, I'm going to go blind if I don't leave this room.
I've got to get out of this time. Yeah.
Or you're staying in the abyss. I think I saw a Transformers movie in the cinema and like 20 minutes in, I just went, well, this isn't anything. So I guess I'm anti-trans is what I'm saying.
This is the exclusive and the pull quote, and I appreciate it. Thank you. You're in comedy. I think we can all agree that that's a fact. What's the film that made you laugh the most?
I think it is. I don't know whether I consider it to be the greatest comedy movie. Team America World Police has made me laugh more than any other film. It's so... When the guy passes, you may need this. You think it's going to be cyanide pills, and it's a hammer with blood and hair on it. And every bit of the movie is funny. The concept of the movie is funny. The songs are funny. I mean, they always do a musical kind of by the back door. You know, you're not quite sure it's a musical, and then it is. I'm So Lonely, so funny. The fact that it's done with puppets, it's so fucking ludicrous. If you pitched it to anyone, they'd just go, well, you're out of your fucking mind. And yet they did it and committed to it, and it's just fantastic. We're going to need an actor, right? Everybody's got AIDS. I mean, everything about it is just, it's so funny. I didn't even get that was a Rent joke at the time. I then had to go and see, I saw Rent and went, it's such a great pastiche.
Oh, I wanted to ask you one other little thing, if I may, which is in your book, you said something which I really liked, which was about being nervous before gigs. And you said, comedians pretend they're not, but they are. And you are. Is that true?
I think there's a recoding of nerves as excitement. I'm really looking forward to this one. Like, I convince myself I'm not nervous before a gig, but I don't eat for 2 hours before it either. So just because, you know, otherwise you'd be feeling kind of a bit queasy. I think it's like that thing where everything becomes a bit normalized. You know, if you do something enough, you kind of go, oh, and you're sort of used to it now. But there's still, especially trying new stuff, I get quite nervous.
I'm so glad to hear it. But don't you think that adrenaline is... You need it. Like, if you didn't, I'm always shocked when I meet people who say, oh, I don't get nervous anymore. I'm like, then how are you doing this job?
Yeah.
Because the super brain or whatever it is kicks in with the Slight adrenaline.
Yeah, it's interesting how you're in a heightened state, like a flow state when you're on stage. And I think sometimes, like, certainly with heckles and things, I think sometimes I've often done a heckle put down where I've not quite got the joke that I've told. Like, you occasionally have this thing where you come back with something and go, well, that was good. And it was like slightly a muscle memory thing, slightly a, you get caught up in it, but your mind's kind of moving at a different speed when you're in that kind of fight or flight mode.
I love that. I cannot thank you enough. This has been a delight. However, when you decided you had an inkling that you wanted to kill yourself, you had a little inkling, but you were like, I need to be sure, so I'm going to take a little journey. And so you booked a flight to South Africa, and along the plane you considered how great your life had been, you considered your family, your wife, your son, and you still thought, no, I'm done. And you thought, I have one more thing. You went to Camp Spey. And
got on the boat.
You went out on a boat to where the great white sharks were. And you thought, yeah, no, I'm still committing to this. And the guide said, oh, so you want to feed the sharks? And he handed you chum, load of meat and stuff. And you grabbed it and you slavered it all over yourself. And the guy went, what the fuck are you doing? And you said, shush, shush, shush. And he went, no, seriously, I've got, like, I get in trouble if something happens to the guests. And you said, I don't care about you and your pathetic little life. And you jumped off the boat and you got eaten viciously by all the sharks that you'd been scared of when you were...
It's hard for them to eat you any other way than viciously.
It was really bad. But the thing was as well, this guy's life was ruined. I mean, you were quite... thoughtless in that this guy's in trouble now, he gets fired, he's getting sued, there's this whole fallout from this thing. The person that filmed it, that was also on the boat, they make a load of money out of it and they don't even use it to help their friend. The guy may even go to prison for this, but you don't care.
I've just been eaten by shark. I do have a boat story in South Africa. If you want to hear it, I'm more than willing to tell it.
Yeah, of course we do. And then we'll get back to your finish.
Okay, so I'm in Cape Town. This has got to be, I don't know, 8 years ago now, whatever. I'm on tour down there doing a couple of shows, Cape Town and Joburg. And I'm there with my other half's there, Caroline's there. And we're staying in the one and only hotel on the bay in Cape Town. And Caroline goes, well, we've got to go and see Robben Island, where, you know, the great man Mandela was interned. I said, yeah, of course we've got to go. So she goes down to the bay thing and they go, oh, the ferry, like, that takes you over there, it's all sold out. And I went, well, surely the hotel can sort us out. And they went, no, we're not connected to the ferry, we can't, but we could book you a private boat. And I went, okay, that sounds pretty good. And I went, well, how much is that? And the guy, sort of like a little bit flustered, whatever, works out, it's like £400, and you get picked up at 10 in the morning and they take you out there and then bring you back at 2 o'clock. And I went, oh, that's okay, great, we'll do that tomorrow. So we come down in the morning in the hotel and we have our breakfast, and there's a line of like six people dressed in sailing outfits in front of us, like little sailor boys, like they're in a little yacht club with our hands behind their backs, like lined up. And you go, oh, that's good, right? I must be doing a thing. And then get to the concierge desk and say, oh, we booked a boat, where do we meet them? And they went, oh, they're here. And they went, oh, right. And they went, where's the rest of your party? And we went, no, it's just us. And they went, oh, it's... Oh, okay. Yeah, I guess so. And then they walk us round to this thing, and there is a super yacht in outside the hotel. Like, literally, I mean, a super yacht, and with full catering on the back of it. And and the captain is a guy that had won the America's Cup. Yeah. And I went, listen, I don't know much about the exchange rate, but nothing about this says £400. And the guy, I got on and went, well, this doesn't seem to make any sense at all. We booked a boat to take us over there. And the guy said it was £400, but this doesn't seem. And we worked out what happened, and he'd got the decimal point in the wrong place, and it was £4,000. And I was like, oh, mate, the thing is, it's just me and the missus, and we just wanted to go over there for like...
And what is it, like a 10-minute drive?
Like it's, 40 minutes or whatever. It's not far. And the guy, like big, gruff sailor from South Africa, goes, ah, my friend, like super aggressive voice. He goes, my friend, these things happen. It's a misunderstanding. Don't worry about it. You have to enjoy your holiday. And I went, right. And he went, don't worry about anything. I kind of left. I kind of walked like 10 steps with Caroline and went, he was really fucking nice about that. And went, oh, fuck it, let's do it. So me and Caroline got back on the boat and went, yeah, no, fuck it, we'll do it. I don't mind. Fine. Take it. Doesn't matter. Whatever. So he's in the most ludicrously opulent way you could ever go and see a prison where a man suffered for 25 years. We went, Caroline was like, I was being teetotal at the time. Caroline downed like 2 bottles of champagne on the way over there. And then when you get to Robben Island, like you're met by someone who used to be interned there and they show you round. She was half cut. It was like, I guess we figured, well, we might as well go.
That's so funny. We'll be getting jet skis back. Don't worry, babe.
Oh, it did. It was like, yeah, it was like getting a white limousine to Auschwitz. It was in very poor taste, but.
So funny. Just walking around drunk going, yeah, looks awful. Looks awful. We need to get back for the lobster.
Awful. Yeah.
Jimmy Carr, is there anything you would like to tell people to look out for, to listen to or to watch of yours coming up?
I've got a book out, which I spent like a year writing, which is, yeah, as we said at the top of the show, it's kind of a love letter to comedy. It's kind of an autobiography, but it's also about you. And it's a way of doing self-help that isn't, I kind of felt like self-help's a bit low hanging fruit, because although it's not a pastiche of self-help, self-help tends to be, it's quite po-faced. It's quite serious. And I like things to be quite light and funny. So it strikes me that it's good. If you need a bit of self-help, but you can't be, yeah, Eckhart Tolle can't write fucking dick jokes, can he?
Yeah, it's really good. What I've read of it, the first third, and I will continue reading it, it is excellent, and I thoroughly recommend it. And you're on tour? I guess you're sold out, are you?
Yeah, I'm on tour around the UK. I probably won't be doing international until next year, year after, something like that, until the corona's all done.
Jimmy Carr, thank you for your time, especially so late at night.
And it's my absolute pleasure. Really, that's a really fun podcast to do. It's great.
Man, I'm delighted to have had you on. Oh, we didn't fucking finish, you monster.
What? I told you another story. What have you got to tell me?
You were eaten by sharks, right? And you ruined this guy's life. And I come over.
Yeah.
I'm like hearing the screaming of the guy. And I was like, what's happened? He's going, oh, Jimmy Carr fucking killed himself. And now my life's ruined. And I was like, oh, shit, man. I'm so sorry. Anyway, I gather the bits of you that are left. And there isn't much. I put it in the coffin, but there's also like, we had to kill a couple of these sharks to get out your bones and shit as well. So it's a real murder-suicide in the end. Stuffing bits of blubber and fucking all the stuff of you in this coffin. It's now absolutely jammed full in there, right? There's only enough room in this coffin for me to slip a DVD, just a little DVD in the side for you to take across to the other side. And on the other side, it's movie night every night. What film are you taking to show the people in heaven when it's your movie night, Jimmy Carr? Go.
Well, I'm going to have to say True Romance, aren't I? I mean, it'd be crazy not to.
After all that.
Because you know what? Because sometimes that's the way it goes, but you have to remember, sometimes it goes the other way too.
It's just ended the podcast by blowing all our minds. Jimmy Carr, thank you. Have a wonderful life. Good day. So that was episode 172. Head over to patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of extra chat, secrets and video with Jimmy. Go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, write about the film that means the most to you and why. It's lovely to read, helps numbers, blah, 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 la, 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 blah, blah, blah. Thank you so much to Jimmy for doing the show so late at night as well. Thank you all for listening to it. Thank you to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics and Lisa Lydon for the photography. Come and join me next week. Oh, I've got such a great guest next week. I'm not even going to tell you who it is. You will very much like it. So I hope everyone is well. That is it for now. But in the meantime, do have a lovely week. And please, be excellent to each other.
Last season, millions tuned into the Betrayal podcast to hear a shocking story of deception. I'm Andrea Gunning, and now we're sharing an all-new story of betrayal. Justin Rutherford. Doctor, father, family man. It was the perfect cover to hide behind.
Detective Weaver said, "I'm sure you know why we're here." I was like, "What in the world is going on?"
Listen to Betrayal on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.